There's a change happening in the way we live, the way we work, the way we spend our money and make our decisions. We are evolving to be more conscious in our actions in a way that serves the world and makes it a better place. Welcome to The Ethical Evolution. The Ethical Evolution podcast is brought to you by the Ethical Change Agency. I'm Bindi, CEO and founder, and I am honoured to bring you the stories of those who create change through paying it forward and giving back. Ethical business owners and holistic healers who are determined to create collective change in the world. Once we have a change in consciousness and through collective change, we can become one. It's often underestimated how much sex and intimacy play a part in the foundation of who we are and how we function. Countless people experience trauma, abuse, dysmorphia, a lack of acceptance for themselves, their bodies, and who they are. There's an embedded shame and fear that if we speak about sex and intimacy that we'll be judged and what we might be experiencing is wrong and embarrassing. The truth is that we're not alone. And in this episode, Dr. Lori Beth Bisbee is on a mission to bring the discussions about sex and intimacy out of the darkness and into the light. There's no boundaries, no judgment, no limitations in working with Dr. Lori Beth as a psychologist and sex and intimacy coach based in the UK. Since 1987, she's been helping individuals, couples, and poly groups explore sexuality, recreate a healthy sexual identity after trauma, as well as deepen their awareness and understanding about intimacy and relationships. There's something empowering and freeing when these conversations come out of the dark and into the light, so I hope you find the courage to do the same regardless of your sexuality. Welcome, Dr. Lori Beth, to The Ethical Evolution.
Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. Now, can you tell us who you are and what you do?
So I'm Dr. Lori Beth Bisbee, and I am a psychologist and a sex and intimacy coach, an author, a speaker, and a podcast host. I work with people to help them create and maintain meaningful relationships that have lots of great sex, but no shame. And one of my areas of specialty is the treatment of trauma. So I work with a lot of people to resolve trauma from relationship violence and sexual violence, but also all sorts of other traumas as well. And the other specialty is gender, sex, and relationship diversity, which means I work with a lot of LGBTQ plus people, people who are having alternative relationships like BDSM or kink, or are non-monogamous.
Wow. Wow. You must be a busy woman.
Yes.
Now, just looking at the spectrum of what you cover, I mean, gosh, you must have some interesting conversations.
Absolutely. my life is not boring.
No. And guys, if you can't see Dr. Lori Beth, she has the brightest red hair. So she's very, very vibrant today. Now, in the work that you do, what would you say is your mission?
I always tell people that my mission is to take sex and conversations about sex from the shadows to the light, because that's the biggest part of my mission, is that sex is part of life and we still treat it like it's something unusual or strange. And it's one of the few areas we really still don't communicate well on. So that's probably my main one. And the other one is really to promote authenticity, because they're related. I think your confidence increases when you're authentic. And so every area of your life improves.
Yeah. And I mean, we're in 2020, right? You know, like, why is it so difficult to talk about sex, regardless of what that is to you?
You know, it's really interesting to me because as a person who talks about it, 2020 is at where we've been going backwards. And this is a really horrible thing to say, but it's true. I've been recently dealing with social media issues because I talk about sex. And we still equate sex with pornography.
Mm.
Everything is thrown into the same sort of ball of wax. You know, it's like when you read terms and conditions for social media and their terms of service, their community guidelines, when you read the community guidelines, it doesn't seem like somebody educating people on sex would have a problem.
Yeah.
But in reality, all you have to do is mention sex and people freak out. And I do believe that that has to do with this swing towards serious conservatism. And it is a moving back in time where this was something that was just too embarrassing and too taboo to talk about.
Mm.
And nobody's ever really gotten it to a place where people just feel like the same way you would go to a doctor if your stomach hurts. You know, you should be going to a doctor if you're having sexual issues. It's no different, but there's still so much, it's this really weird disparity. It's used for entertainment and to sell, and it's used in a very, what's the word I want? It's used in a manner that actually isn't consistent for what it is.
Mm. Yeah. And
so on the one hand, sex is everywhere. And on the other hand, when it actually comes down to two people wanting to do something with each other, then it becomes this thing that's almost impossible to discuss.
Yeah.
And what's really frightening now is that because we have the internet, I had this conversation with an erotica author that I'm really fond of the other day. And we were talking about the fact that because we're both old folk, I'm 57.
No way.
Yeah, no, I am. I'm 57. The red hair helps me not look 57, but I am.
You do not look it.
Thank you. So he's, he's 55, and we were talking about it, and I was saying, you know, part of what it is that we learned about sex by experimenting because there was nothing to watch to learn about sex. You know, you had what your parents told you, which in my case was pitifully little. And then you had sex education at school, which was ridiculous.
Oh yeah.
And so we learned by experimenting. So you would meet somebody, you would fall for them, you would try and do something and either it would work or it wouldn't. And you experimented with other people, you experimented with your own body. You didn't talk about it because nobody talked about it, but you might read a book, but we knew the difference between what was fantasy and what was reality, because by the time we saw entertainment depictions of sex, we were already having sex ourselves.
Mm.
So we already knew that what we saw on the screen, if we watched a pornographic film, was not real because we'd already experienced what it was.
Mm.
So for us, there was the big differentiation between what was reality and what was fantasy. And so we didn't use pornography and things like that as education. But the last couple of generations are coming up in a world where nobody talks about sex. Nobody teaches them about sex, but there's access to pornography. And so they think that's what sex is.
Mm.
And they can't distinguish between fantasy and reality when it comes to sex. I mean, I constantly say to people, no, that's entertainment, not education.
Mm.
Education involves learning to talk. It involves, you know, all the less exciting parts.
Yeah, yeah, so true. And, yeah, you're right. It's like we've gone backwards, isn't it? Like we went through the whole mental health thing, like people not wanting to talk about that and the stigma behind that. And we're starting to get to a place where that's getting a bit more of a better narrative. But now, look at sex. Like how many people would go to the doctor now and go, hey, I need to talk about this? They just wouldn't nowadays, would they?
Well, no. And part of it is, I mean, I'll give you examples of why people don't. So a 60-year-old man is diagnosed with prostate cancer and asks the doctor, the urologist, about sexual function. And the urologist blows the question off.
Yeah.
And doesn't answer.
Yeah.
And it implies that it's much more important to think about making sure you save your life than to think about your sexual function, as if both aren't important.
Yeah. And that then has a mental health effect as well.
Absolutely.
You know, if you can't sexually function properly, that impacts all of your life.
Absolutely. And we don't talk about that either. Mm. And it's a huge effect. So we still believe that sort of people over the age of 50 are past it, which I find absolutely amazing because, you know, it's just so untrue. There are people have sex into their 90s, their 100s. If they're able to do it, they will do it. That doesn't stop.
Yeah, so true. Yeah. I know people over 50 that, well, yeah, they're more active than some people in their 20s.
I have better sex now than I did in my 20s.
Yeah, well, you know what you're doing now.
Absolutely. And that's the point. I know what I'm doing. I'm not ashamed of what I want. I know how to talk about what I want and to ask for what I want.
Mm.
All of those mean I'm going to have better sex.
Well, you know, you're more empowered now too, aren't you? Like,
absolutely. Mm. But it doesn't need to be that way.
No.
If we actually raised people that this is a part of life, that there are many different ways to do this and many different expressions of yourself, and that all of them are valid, and gave people the support that they needed to discover who they were, taught them how to communicate. So a lot of what I end up talking with people about isn't really sex. I mean, I do talk a lot about sex and I teach a lot about sex, but the basic skills are the things that people are missing.
Mm.
They're missing really good communication skills. I mean, really good communication skills. They don't know how to be present. And this is worse now than it ever was before because people multitask.
Yeah.
You know, they have six screens and they're having a conversation. Being present is one of the best gifts you can give in a relationship, to actually be fully there. And it's necessary for good sex.
Mm.
Good sex requires you to be present. So nobody knows how to do that anymore. They don't know how to soothe themselves when they're upset, which means that everything needs to be dealt with right now.
Yeah.
They don't know how to negotiate. Because, again, these are just skills that they haven't learned, or reality test.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a list of things that are what I consider to be emotional and relationship skills, life skills, emotional life skills, that we don't get taught anywhere at school. And because it's assumed that we'll learn from our parents.
Mm.
But if our parents don't have good skills, then we're not going to have good skills.
Mm.
And we're not going to know it until we're out in the world failing all over the place, you know, and then being upset about the fact that we can't have a decent relationship and we don't understand why. Or and one of the most common ones that I hear on a very regular basis from women is, I can have an orgasm by myself, but I never have an orgasm with a partner, no matter what they do. Is it technique? Well, probably not, right? That's the most common, is that they don't trust enough to let go.
Yeah.
And there are ways to teach you how to make a good risk assessment so you can learn to trust someone. But again, that none of that is considered important. It's relegated to, you should be able to figure this out, or you should magically know.
Oh,
it's magically okay.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today, Dr. Lori Beth, was, you know, when we look at relationships and trust, and those who have gone through sexual trauma, so I myself have, and it can really impact your ability to get back into that kind of space with someone in a relationship, and who you are in that space, and to trust someone that's not going to happen again. How do you help people through that?
So there's two parts to that. And I learned this having been through severe sexual violence, and my recovery and then growth came in two parts. And one of the parts is looking at the actual trauma itself. And if people are still having intrusive thoughts about the trauma, if they're still able to be triggered into it, even if only when they're in bed, then it's worth doing work around the trauma so that that is dealt with to the point where it is really in the past, which means that you don't get triggered into it. So you don't feel like you're there. You don't have flashbacks. You don't have intrusive imagery. You don't feel the emotions from the time. It doesn't mean that you never think about it or that it never existed. I mean, it did, it happened, but it's firmly in the past instead of in the present. Because when we're triggered, it's like everything is happening again. Yeah. So the trauma is really in your present at that point. So that's step one. And then that works really well to handle everything for only a small percentage of people who have had experienced sexual violence. The second part of it is actually working on those skills and is actually helping a person not be triggered in that different way in the moment. Mm. They need to learn a new pattern of being able to trust that somebody will touch them appropriately, being really clear on what they want so that they can ask, being really clear about consent and good at negotiation and the communication. And that's, you know, skills building and helping people do that in situ, which is the bit that normally doesn't get dealt with if you go to therapy.
Yep.
So that to me is the coaching part, and the other is the therapy part. And the reason is because people don't really think about it being necessary. The myth has been for a long time that if you resolve the other stuff, then automatically people will move into healthy patterns. But the fact is, if you don't have adaptive skills, you're not going to get them by osmosis, right? Mm. You cling to the skills you have because they helped you and they were good at some time. Most people aren't stupid. They don't do things over and over again that cause them pain. They do things that have worked in the past.
Yeah.
So when you take away the stuff that they're trying to handle, they don't have new skills. So they'll go back to the old skills. So you've got to give people that set of skills.
Yeah.
And I remind people all the time, you're not broken. You're just missing skills.
Mm. Yeah.
Because most of the time, if you've been through sexual violence, you start to feel like you're broken. Like you can't have a relationship. You can't function sexually. There's something wrong with you because these things happen over and over again and it never works right. And that's really just the effects of the trauma, that and not having the skills that you need.
And I think another thing that we see happen so often is, you know, a lot of people who have gone through, you know, sexual trauma of any kind, they often don't talk about it. They don't deal with it. They hide it. And it's something that they'll carry with them all the time.
There's two problems with that. One is, of course, if you don't deal with it, then you're not going to do better later.
Mm.
You may not have another relation. You may have a better relationship in that the person that you're with doesn't cause you harm, but you're not going to be fully present if you haven't dealt with it.
Mm.
And that's the other big problem is that if you've got live trauma and you don't have great skills, you've got a neon sign on your forehead that says, I'm easy prey. And I often get clobbered when I talk about this to people, like, you're blaming the victim. It's like, no, I'm not. This is a fact of how things work. And if you look in the animal kingdom, predators look for the weak, the infirm, the ones who seem like something's off. If you have unresolved sexual trauma, it's like walking down a street in a dangerous city with a pair of headphones on your ears. Right?
Yeah.
Because you're not present. So there are things you're missing. And a predator can see that. That's their job. Their job is to find prey. So they can see that. They'll pick you instead of somebody else. It's not, I'm not saying that if you do all these things, you would never be a victim, because that's not true.
Mm.
You control what you can control, and they're responsible for what they're doing. However, if you do these things, you're in much better shape and you look like everybody else in that way. You're not standing out. And it can be hard for people to grasp that and take that on. But this is about protecting yourself because nobody else is going to do that for you.
Yeah, that's so true. And can I just say, it took me many years to learn that. Many years, because I kept attracting the same kind of thing and it kept happening over and over. And I'm like, this is you. You got to deal with this.
Yeah. But it's you, but not you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because what people think is, this is me. There's something wrong with me. I'm a bad person. That's why. And it's like, no, this is unresolved stuff. And once you resolve the stuff, then it's not you anymore. Then you'll be able to see it.
Yeah.
If you can't see the pattern, you're just going to keep repeating it.
That's it. That's it. And once I picked up on that pattern, I went, okay, we're going to break this now. And it stopped.
And that's always so amazing.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about today is the LGBTQ community and identity, sexual identity in a relationship. So for me, when I came out, I was very, very different to how I am now, can I just say? And I think probably a lot of people who identify as gay, lesbian, whatever it might be, have this inner turmoil or struggle that they don't know what they should be. And I think the thing that I've learned is that whatever you are is okay, and that evolves over time. And you get to learn, who you really are. What kind of work do you do in that area with people in the LGBTQ community?
I mean, I see a lot of individuals who are struggling to figure out gender and identity.
Yeah.
Which are obviously two different things.
Yeah.
With sexual identity and sexual orientation, it's like you are who you should be. You just need to let yourself be that.
That's it, yeah.
And so a lot of the work I do with people is helping them to look at themselves without pulling away.
Yeah.
Because once they start that process, then you can support them in just becoming whoever they are. And then I spend a lot of time helping people talk to relatives and deal with friends and deal with society's negative reactions. I mean, if people seem to think that, you know, it's not a problem anymore, that society's fine with it. And it's just not true. I mean, people suffer discrimination all over the place for, you know, any of the letters of the rainbow. You know, it is really difficult when people come out. And it's there are groups for which it can be harder. I mean, bisexuality is still, you know, a very difficult one for people to come out with because there's discrimination on both sides.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of people just tell, you know, just you're greedy. It's like, no, this is just who I am. But it's as you say, it's an evolving. And so I end up spending a lot of time with people helping them and supporting them in doing that. And the same sorts of sets of skills and dealing with the same kinds of previous trauma. Sometimes people are really unaware of what supports are available out there or don't even know where to go in terms of dating or what they do or they're shy. And it's just, you know, I think that people forget is if you're not somebody who comes out as a teenager, then it's a second adolescence in a sense, because you're so shy and all the things you were when you first started dating heterosexually, there's no difference. So if you don't have the fortune of knowing that young, then you end up having to go through this second period of adjustment while you figure out what dating looks like and what kind of a relationship you actually want and what sex might look like. And so that's the other thing I end up dealing with, which is sexual problems, you know, which don't evaporate because people figure out what their orientation is.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
And couples. And so I deal with a lot of couples because I also do non-monogamy. That I get a lot of LGBTQ couples who are trying to decide if they're monogamous or non-monogamous. So I spend a lot of time there.
Wow. So I guess in same-sex relationships, one of the questions I do have for you is, say you're in a relationship and you're fairly recently have come out, and you're exploring your sexuality and what feels right for you. And let's say you've found something that really works for you and you know, fires you up, but your partner hates it. What do you recommend people do in that kind of situation?
We start with negotiation. Mm-hmm. And we start to see if actually does the person hate it or hate part of it? Hate all of it? Is there some small bit of it they can be okay with? Because it's really hard if one person, there's something that really works for them.
Yeah.
And the other one's like, yeah, no. Mm. So there's some negotiation around whether you can do some of it, find some part of it that'll work, or even, well, maybe you don't hate it. You just don't really, it's not your favorite thing, but you're willing to do that if your partner's willing to do the thing that isn't their favorite thing.
Mm.
Sometimes that doesn't work. And then you're looking at things like, is this something that you can deal with in fantasy with masturbation and or bring the fantasy into the couple? So you're having sex in one way, but you're talking about the stuff that really turns you on. So there's lots of ways that you can kind of bring it in through the back door in a sense that will allow everybody to get their needs met. And sometimes some people do consider non-monogamy. That is an option for people in the situation, particularly when for example, if somebody discovers they're kinky and their partner really isn't, and has no interest whatsoever, sometimes negotiations can be made about going somewhere else to do the kinky stuff, as long as the same type of sex isn't being had, is often one of the conditions. Yeah. It's like, I don't mind if you go over there and get a spanking, but I don't want you having oral sex with that person. And so you can negotiate some of those things. But I think the most important part of it is both partners being willing to think outside the box if necessary, and recognizing that the important bit is that you're each getting your needs met and that you're committed to each other and work on getting those needs met.
So it really clearly shows how important communication is in those situations, because one, if you don't tell each other what really works for you or what doesn't, that's where you can start to get cracks and things can start to fall apart.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'd say that probably about a third of the people that come to me is because they don't feel they can tell their partner what they want.
Mm. Wow.
Sometimes they're afraid that they're going to be rejected. Sometimes they're afraid their partner's going to be disgusted and then the relationship will be over. Other times they just can't say it. They can't bring themselves. They're actually so disgusted by themselves. They can't even go there.
Yeah.
But that's about a third of the people that see me where that's the problem.
Wow. And thank God you're around, because people need this so much. Now, talking about the people that you help, can you give us some examples of, you know, the kind of change you've helped people make?
Okay, so some of my trauma clients are amazing. I think of one woman that I worked with who had experienced extreme sexual violence as a child, who had never managed to have a sexual relationship as an adult. She was in her 40s, and she'd never managed to have a sexual relationship as an adult where she actually felt anything during the sex. So she was so traumatized that she dissociated. So she was basically felt like she was standing outside her body watching herself.
Wow.
That's where we were when we started. When we finished, she'd been married for, I think she had been married for about 6 years by then. And when we finished, so we spent a year working with each other because she had lots of stuff that needed to be dispersed. And then she needed the confidence to be able to try things again. But they had sex where she had an orgasm for the first time.
Wow.
After the 6 years. Yeah. And it was the first time she'd had an orgasm during sex with a partner. I hasten to say it wasn't during intercourse, and that's not unusual, because it's about 28 to 35% of women never have orgasms with penetrative sex. So, you know, that's just a statistic. It doesn't have to do with trauma. It's just the way it is. It's the way we're built. Yeah. But she did have her first orgasm with him. And then 2 years later, they were still going strong. And she was always amazed. She was like, and the trauma didn't come back, which was wonderful. So her life changed completely.
Yeah.
Because she'd been holding on to that for so long, and it hampered every aspect of her life.
Yeah. So when someone can get that freedom and that expression in a loving way, like, it just opens you up, really, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we all need that. And even people who are asexual need affection, right? Mm. There's, you know, so it may not be sexual intimacy, but there's still intimacy. And sometimes when people have had severe sexual violence, it's really very difficult for them to have any kind of physical intimacy, even physical affection, because touch has become such a negative thing.
Yeah.
And that really hampers relationships, and it also hampers personal growth and development and feeling good in yourself.
Yeah, it just touches so many parts of our lives, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that's one. I've helped couples successfully go from monogamous to non-monogamous, which is an amazing transition to make. I can think of three in the last 5 years that have opened their relationships up successfully and still remain together and happy. And there were no crashes and no crashing and burning, no divorces. No. It's usually easier if you come to a relationship knowing you're non-monogamous with another non-monogamous person. But all three of these couples, it was something that evolved out of the relationship. One couple was because of what I was describing before, where, you know, she wanted one thing and he was just like, you know, I never am going to want to go there. Mm. And I don't have anything. It doesn't disgust me. It doesn't upset me. It doesn't bother me that you want to go there. It's just, I am so uninterested. I don't think I could be convincing. So that's where they started.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very brave thing for people to explore that in a relationship, whereas most people would just walk away and go find someone else who isn't into their stuff, you know. Like, I think that's such a brave thing to do, to still stick together when you can't meet each other's needs in that way.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's not a choice for everyone to make. Mm. There are, you know, I also help people break up when that's the appropriate thing to do. Mm. Because you can do that in a way that is respectful to each other, in a way that preserves the positives that you had in the relationship and preserves, particularly if you have kids, preserves the ability to work together. Or you can crash and burn everything. And so it's, even if people can't find a way to make that adjustment with each other, if they can care about each other enough to want the other person to be happy, then there's a process you can go through to separate amicably. And I think it's important. I think, you know, if you can't meet each other's basic sexual needs, it's going to be hard to keep a relationship together unless you can find a workaround. Because not getting those needs met for your whole life makes for a miserable human.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
depression and anxiety are really common when none of those needs are being met.
Yeah, so true. So in the work that you do, what would you say is the biggest challenge that you face and how do you overcome it?
Me personally, as the provider, now there's a couple. I think sometimes it's being able to see it from all the viewpoints that can be very challenging, and so it's that for me, the way that I get through that is to take a step back from the whole thing, and sort of look at it like it's a puzzle to see where the pieces fit. And so that's one. Some trauma work, it can be challenging not to take the emotions home.
Yeah.
That's the other one. And not to be triggered. I don't get triggered into my own stuff because that stuff was done. I've dealt with that so long ago that that's not live, but triggered by the fact that it's so horrible. What some people come in to tell me is so horrible that it can be really difficult not to, to take that all in. And some of the way that I deal with that is because I work in a really specific way when I'm dealing with trauma. And so my focus is completely on the other person. So I'm not in here. I can feel, but I'm not taken into the feelings because I'm focused on the person outside of me. Also, because I don't end sessions, trauma sessions, while somebody's in the middle of upheaval, I work until we reach a good point to end the session. And that has a specific definition. Trauma is a bell curve. Anxiety goes up, it peaks, and eventually it will go down. So I don't allow somebody to leave a session where they're at the top of that anxiety, because that's re-traumatizing.
Yeah.
So that helps, because by the time they leave, they're feeling better. And so I've rode the wave with them. So I'm feeling better. But still, sometimes you take it home, and then I deal with it by doing something pleasurable for me. Sometimes I have to just, you know, go and take the dog for a walk or sit and have a cuddle with the dog. Sometimes I write. Sometimes I play music. Sometimes I grab my husband, you know. Depends on what's going on.
And, you know, it's a common theme I see with people in your field of work is that you've got to have great self-care because you can't heal others if you don't take care of yourself. So I think that is super important for people in your field, as no doubt Absolutely. You see. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we need our own supports. I have a friend that I talk to every week without fail. It's, you know, it's funny, before the pandemic, we didn't do this, but since the pandemic we do. And now afterwards, I'm sure we'll continue. And we make time for each other every week. And sometimes we're just laughing about something. And sometimes one of us is supporting the other. Sometimes we're taking turns. It's just, it's that space to just be completely elsewhere. It's just so important.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the blessings of the pandemic, to be honest, is that we've developed a greater ability for human connection regardless of where we are. And I think that is so good out of this year, if we could find anything good.
No, I mean, I certainly think that it's brought home a lot of things about relative importances and things. I was commuting a lot before this. I've had an office in London for 20 years. I don't have an office in London anymore. Mm. And while I still enjoy the city, I don't feel any need to be there and any need to to meet people in person on a regular basis. I mean, I'll start doing in-person events again because I love to do events, couples events, individual events. So I'll start doing those again once things are safer. But because I don't feel that need to have the office in London, that opens up a whole world about where I can live. Mm. You know, so it's done a lot of sort of reordering for a lot of people, myself included.
Yeah. Yeah, and probably save yourself some time and money at the same time.
I should hope so.
Now, I love asking this question, and I'd be keen to hear your response because there's no wrong answer. Can you define for me what being ethical means to you?
Acting in a way that I can look in the mirror and feel good about myself. Mm. That's my simplest definition. So, I mean, I could get all philosophical and talk about lack of harm and, you know, treating people equally and all of these things that are very important to me. But for me, being ethical is to be able to look in the mirror and feel good about me and so not feel like I've done something that, goes against my own internal code.
Mm, yeah. I love that. So what are you working on at the moment? Like, what's your future plans? I know it can be a bit difficult to plan at the moment with what's going on in the world, but what's ahead for you?
So I finished a draft of a book let's wind this back. I released my memoir in May of 2020 in the middle of this.
Oh, wow.
It's an erotic memoir. So it's got a piece of erotica, a piece of my life story, and then a little piece of analysis for each section. And then I wrote the draft to the follow-up book from that, which is a self-help book to teach people skills to recover from gaslighting and trauma. Mm. And so I wrote that draft in November. I've just given revisions to my mentor who I do book stuff with. And so I think that'll be out. I'm sure that'll be out the beginning of January. I'm halfway through a collection of erotica, which should be out sometime in January. And I got a couple of other book projects running around. I've got an event that I'm doing. I'm doing my normal retreat, but I'm doing it virtual. So I'm doing a 2.5-day retreat at the end of January. So that should be fun. But I think long-term, like if I'm looking at the next year, my plan is to just do more teaching, more events, more group stuff, and more writing and broadcasting and stuff. I love podcasting. I've got one that's the A to Z of Sex, which has been around since 2016.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been weekly since 2016. And
that's insane. Oh, well done you.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't think I would still be doing it, but I love it. I have a great time. So, and then I do an erotica one that I started a couple months back, which has been fun. I'll do more television and more broadcasting because I just have a ball. So, yeah, I'll probably be even more visible than I already am. And also to take bigger breaks, take really defined bigger breaks. I mean, that's something that I haven't been very good at. And I need to be much better at defining. So we hope I'm going to be better at planning.
We'll see. It sounds like you're going to be super busy, and I'm so, so glad to hear that you are going to be more visible. And no doubt I think you and I are going to be talking some more because, it's one of my plans for 2021 as well. So I think there's some opportunities there.
Absolutely. And hopefully I will get – I've been to Australia once for a very brief time. And I'd like to come back and actually see properly. The only thing I really saw was Far North Queensland.
Oh, nice. Which
is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
You know, but I spent like 5 days, a week in Australia, which is like, you know, like spending a week in America. Like you do nothing. It's a week.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spot. So yeah, you'll have to come back down because it's so beautiful. Now, if people want to find out more about you and get in touch with you, where can they go?
The easiest is drloribethbisbee.com. And so that's drloribethbisbee.com.
Excellent.
You can find me on Facebook, Dr. Lori Beth Bisbee, on Twitter and Instagram at Dr. Bisbee, and on TikTok, Lori Beth UK. And I do a lot of TikTok.
She's a TikToker.
I have so much fun. And emailing me is really the always the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Now I've got the final big question for you, Dr. Lori Beth. What's the change you'd like to see in the world and how can we bring it to life?
I want to see everybody talking to each other, you know, which is not surprising given what I've said the whole time. I really would like to see a world in which people are allowed to be who they are, which is which requires communication. And I guess the way we can bring it about is first by acknowledging and owning who we are and at owning not only our positive points, but our negative points and doing the work on ourselves so that we feel happy being who we are. And then being willing to be non-judgmental with people.
Yes.
That's like one of the biggest things that seems to have gone out the window. Even things that I think are important, like when somebody's done something wrong, like bringing their awareness to what they've done, we no longer do that in any kind of a positive way. We, you know, cancel culture, we scream and we shout at people. We do it in ways that mean that somebody's not likely to get any growth out of it or even be able to accept what you say. Because if you're really aggressive to somebody, their first response is to be defensive.
Mm.
So they're not going to hear you if they're being defensive. So I'd like us to learn how to do that differently so we could start to understand each other instead of fight with each other so much.
Yeah, well, I guess it comes back down to, again, communication and letting go of that judgment because, you know, it's pretty much the root of where all our issues come in relationships and understanding each other as communities and identities. And, yeah, let's try and turn that ship around, huh?
We'd love to. I mean, most of the judgment comes because people are frightened, you know, because something is different. There's nothing to be frightened of. You can just go, it's different. It doesn't mean I have to like it. I can go, ooh, that's interesting, right?
Yeah.
And I can be nice to you. And I don't have to take part in whatever it is you're doing that I'm not interested in. I can go, but I can be friendly and I can be nice and I can find out the place where we have something in common.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh, Dr. Lori Beth, I can't thank you enough for being part of the Ethical Evolution. It's been an absolute joy.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Ethical Evolution podcast. If you're an ethical business owner, change maker, or holistic healer who's determined to make a change in the world and you need support to spread your message, visit ethicalchangeagency.com to collaborate.